From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Editor and journalist Harold Evans joins us for a special pre-recorded edition of Forum all about American innovation and inventiveness from the steam engine to the search engine. He captures two centuries of those who made America in his newest book, and we'll talk with him about everyone from Thomas Edison and Alexander Graham Bell to Russell Simmons and Ted Turner. Forum is next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny, and this is a special pre-recorded edition of Forum, in which we have an opportunity to talk with editor, journalist, and historian Harold Evans all about his newest book, They Made America, a compendium of American inventiveness, innovation, entrepreneurial spirit, know-how, and transformational progress led by two centuries of the nation's greatest leading spearheaders and revolutionary thinkers. Harold Evans is the author of The American Century and was editor of the Sunday Times of London and then The Times, as well as heading up Condé Nast Traveler and Random House. He was editorial director and vice chair of U.S. News & World Report, The Atlantic, Fast Company, and The New York Daily News. And in 2004, he was knighted by Queen Elizabeth. And he joins us for this special pre-recorded edition of Forum. And welcome, Sir Harold. Last time you were here, you were not Sir Harold. You were plain Harold.
You can dispense with the knighthood for the moment.
Well, tell us about it, though. Was it a thrill?
It was wonderful, absolutely wonderful. I mean, when I went to the palace and had to kneel before the sovereign, and they said, "Can you kneel?" I said, "Yeah, but I'm not sure I can get up." So they appreciated that. I did manage to get up. And it was what was touching about the whole ceremony was to see the kind of people who were being honored. A soldier from Iraq, a nurse, somebody working in a hospice, somebody in local government, somebody who'd cured a dreadful disease. It was marvelous. The whole range of British life was there. And I felt very privileged and touched to be knighted, actually.
And understand why, especially with those kind of people. But you have made a great contribution as well. And most recently, actually, if there were a knighting here in America, you would probably be meriting that because you've given so much to American history with the books that you've done. And in some ways, have probably know more about this nation's history now than most Americans, I would say.
Well, that would be arrogant, but actually I was surprised when I first came to the States in the 50s by, one, the drama of American history, and two, how much of it seemed not to be remembered. And this book I've done now, surprisingly, astonishingly, bewilderingly, is the first history of 200 years of American enterprise. Dan Boorstein did some social and cultural books which were marvelous. But nobody's put together the concerted 200 years from independence to what we have today.
And it's that, a PBS series, too?
A PBS series grew out of the book, and that's a four-part PBS series. They've taken about 12 characters and dramatized it marvelously. For instance, in San Francisco, when I made the film about Giannini, the founder of the Bank of America, they've reproduced the fire of San Francisco and the earthquake. Well, the fire's really impressive.
Let me talk about Giannini for a moment, as long as we're in San Francisco and as long as you brought up the name, because I learned from your work, for example, something I never knew, that he became a banker because they closed him out. He was angry.
He was very angry. Well, he came over on the Transcontinental Railway as a fetus in the womb. And when he landed, when he was born, his father was murdered, and they started selling fruit and veg, he and his mother, on the wharf in San Francisco. He married well. And the father of his bride died, leaving a seat on the tiny Bank of Italy. And Giannini was absolutely appalled. They would not lend money to people who needed it. They'd only lend you money if you didn't need it, i.e. to the rich. And he wanted to lend money to the poor immigrants, bringing up families, wanting to buy houses. And they thought he was total radical. I mean, they would have accused him of being a communist, probably. So he quit. And he started his own bank. And it was a marvelous day when fishmongers and others came through the door to deposit their tiny savings. And he started lending money, sitting himself in the bank, being open to everybody. And, of course, it's a very long and dramatic story of what he did in the San Francisco earthquake when he saved the money and then opened up a bank on the wharf between two barrels with a plank across them. And he thrust money into the hands of sea captains saying, "Go north, get lumber, rebuild San Francisco."
He was also presented by you with kind of warts and all, too. I mean, the anti-Semitic comment, which sort of surprised me.
Well, he was standard for the course at the time. He gave money to start Israel, so he did appreciate. He wasn't anti-Jewish, but when he ran up against Morgenthau's obstructionism and they were trying to close down his huge bank, objecting to the extension, he did make anti-Semitic remarks, and they have to be remembered, just like Henry Ford became an anti-Semite in his later life, just like Edmund Morse was a racist. Samuel Morse was a racist. We have to put these people in their context. But Gene Inney was a good man. He did far more good than he did harm. And California has a huge deal to him because the Golden Gate Bridge, for instance, was financed by bonds that Gene Inney bought himself after Wall Street had tried to shut him down totally.
There is, I want to get to some of the other people that you profile here and that you give us a history of. And by the way, where'd you get all these wonderful diagrams that we see in the beginning and the end
patent drawings. Yeah. Well, I got them. I went to the U.S. Patent Office and they make them available to you.
Yeah, it's great.
It's a wonderful institution, the U.S. Patent Office. It's been going, of course, for nearly 200 years, too.
I wanted to just talk about the conception here. It's a three-part book, though. It covers two centuries, and it takes us through so many movers and shakers and so many extraordinary people. But you also have some significant things that I want to say in a generic way about inventiveness, because these are people who, as you say, put inventiveness to use, and also about innovation. And I guess one time it almost sounds like an aphorism, invention without innovation is a pastime.
Well, it is an aphorism, but it seemed to me to sum up the thing, because I imagine myself as many inventors inventing something in an attic and it's staying there. I mean, just imagine if Thomas Edison had invented an incandescent light bulb, as he did at Menlo Park in 1879, and that was it. But no, he went on to manufacture them in mass, to lay the wires, the circuits, produce the dynamos, sell the electricity, raise the capital, outwit the gas companies, get round the corrupt city administration and bring power and lighting to downtown Manhattan, a significant number of blocks. That's innovation. Take Alexander Graham Bell. If we were dependent on the telephone he, quote, invented, utterly useless. You know, when he said, Mr. Watson, come here, and Mr. Watson came, and that was the birth of the telephone. Watson said later, the Bell telephone was a wonderful instrument for developing the human lungs. You couldn't hear. And Bell abandoned it and went off on his honeymoon. He had a proper sense of priorities, you might say. And so it was left to Edison and Theodore Vail to innovate the telephone.
I guess that's the point that one keeps coming back to in many of these portraits. These things are not out of thin air. They require a great deal of follow-through. You mentioned Edison, for example, and Edison, I mean, what you seem to extol here is the long process of development, the commercial intuitiveness and just enterprise that he used. And, I mean, this is a man, as you point out, who had almost 1,100 patents, but he wouldn't be remembered at all had it not been for that push and that commercial drive. And when Alexander Graham Bell, you come right out and say he wasn't an innovator.
That's right, he was not. And neither was the man who invented Xerox machine, invented a copying instrument, Carlson and Queens. He never followed through. He could never make it to work. And a guy called Joseph Wilson bet his company over many years, $60 million, into developing what became Xerox. Without Wilson, there would have been no Xerox. Many inventions do not get very... Let's take a brilliant example. San Francisco again. Herbert Boyer splices a gene, gets E. coli bacteria, and enters a genetic material to produce insulin in the bacteria, which is a fantastic achievement. But it doesn't stay at that. With Robert Swanson, they put $500 down together and create Genentech, the start of the biotech industry. That is an innovator, a supreme innovator.
You want to bring up to the public who's reading this book the real recognition of this kind of innovation, make us really super aware of what it means and how it's done.
I think it's terribly important. It's amazing that American history has neglected the innovators, the people of enterprise. We've had 200 years of talking about presidents. Well, presidents, yes, so they come and go, and some of them are good and some of them are less good. But they all depend for their fulfillment of their promises on the innovators. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness needs somebody to plant the wheat and reap it with the reaper, McCormick's reaper, and travel and so on and so on. So we really should study these people, not just for the inspiration, though they certainly provide that with the way they overcome failure, But also, you cannot understand American history. Nobody can understand American history if they stick just to the politics.
Well, you also understand how there's a kind of Yankee ingenuity that comes across in reading many of these profiles. You understand what you call practical innovation and how there was lots of practical innovation. By the way, educate me about something. Why did Dr. Johnson shudder when he heard the word innovation?
Well, Dr. Johnson didn't like change. He preferred things to stay the same as they were. And all this innovation, he frowned upon it. Like many people today say, I wish we hadn't bothered inventing the movie studio and so on, you know. He was a wonderful reactionary.
Crusty curmudgeon. He comes across.
Well, in the British tradition of that, you know. He said with a touch of humor.
But there is a sense of U.S. supremacy in all this innovation, which may indeed be, kind of like the British Empire in its decline.
There are signals that American innovation may be not rising as fast as it traditionally has. If you look at the number of patents given to American innovators, the number of Nobel Prizes, the number of scientific papers, and so on, the fall off in the teaching of science, which is very often a prerequisite of innovation, but not a necessity, let me add, which concerns the American Academy of Sciences. So one of the things I hope will happen with my book is that some people will get hold of it, younger people will get hold of it, and will see, be inspired, be encouraged to get over failure and to realize what fantastic things can be achieved by persistence. You know, many of the people, Michael, in this book are not scientists. They put things together, combinations of things. Think of Malcolm McLean as a trucker, North Carolina, sees people loading boats piecemeal with bits and pieces, and he thinks, why don't they all... Wouldn't it be wonderful if I could just put my truck on the boat? And 20 years later, he invents the container ship. Think of Sternberg thinking, wouldn't it be great if I could go somewhere and get an inkjet for my printer machine instead of finding futile going from place to place? And he invents a supermarket for office products, Staples. These things are very often staring you in the face, and they're combinations of other ideas rather than simple inventions.
Synthesis,
thank you. That's a good word.
Talking with Harold Evans, who has synthesized histories from the steam engine to the search engine, 2 centuries of innovators in his book, They Made America. Beautiful book, by the way. He's the author of The American Century and also A Knight, as I said earlier. That makes him blush a little bit, but nonetheless, that's quite an accomplishment. And he has many of them. Do you identify with these innovators? Because in a sense, your whole career as a historian, coming up with stories like this, your career as an editor, as a journalist, I mean, you've cut a pretty broad swath.
Well, I'd be flattered. I don't have enough self-regard to think I have done some innovative things, but nothing on the scale of the people that I've written about. And thank heavens I haven't had as dramatic and colourful a life as some of these people who go through all sorts of melodramas. I mean, each of these stories is like a novel with what they face. I mean, I just take Isaac Singer, for instance, 18 bastard children, 4 common law wives, strangles one of them, goes to Europe. Marries the woman whose face becomes the Statue of Liberty, Isabella.
I mean, that's you don't mean Isaac Singer, I think.
I mean Isaac Singer.
Now wait a minute, I'm confusing with the Nobel Isaac Bacheva Singer.
Talking about Singer the sewing machine.
Singer the sewing machine.
You're far too elevated for this conversation.
Singer the Yiddish writer Isaac Bacheva.
I mean, I'm thinking of people like that, or people like Edwin Armstrong, who gave us radio, who fights titanic battles with RCA and the big media, having given us wonderful FM music and radio and enabled us to talk to the moon if there was somebody on it and so on. But he ends up jumping out of a window not far from where I live in New York. He's so frustrated. So the lives are truly dramatic. And what is really kind of puzzling is why have they been neglected for so long?
You're also talking about, as you're talking about suicide, John Fitch, of course.
He opens the book. We open the book with a suicide. I'm happy to say we don't close it with one with Google, Larry Page and Sergey Brin. John Fitch is the man before Fulton who runs the steamboat service on the Delaware, pursued by Red Indians, whatever you like to call them, Native Americans, except everybody called them Red Indians then, and escapes being scalped, just, and thinks next time I'm going to have a steam engine. And there's not a steam engine in America. He has to invent one with a German clockmaker. And the service on the Delaware doesn't succeed, but it's the first steamboat service. Then he gets so frustrated, he takes an overdose of opium.
So many of these stories, as you say, could be novels in and of themselves. And so many of these stories seem to harken back to the idea that you have that, big surprise, you think of America and innovation, you often think about capitalism, you think about people driven by avarice. Not the case with almost all of these.
No, I tell you, let's just think of Martha Harper for a minute. She's a servant girl. She's very sick. Christian Science rescues her. She has deep faith. She has the idea of opening beauty parlors. She invents a shampoo chair where you recline your head in the chair. She doesn't patent it. And then she has a marvelous idea that her system of beauty treatment could be copied. So she franchises women around the country, 500 franchises she gives. That's the start of the entire franchise retail network from a servant girl.
Many from humble beginnings here, of course. But again, back to the question of motivation. I mean, you have people who are motivated by God, by faith, by all kinds of things.
A tremendous number. They're not dominated by it. They're not a theocracy here. But an amazing number of them. Take Raymond.
Even now with the re-election? No, I'm sorry.
No. No. I tell you, their faith doesn't get in the way of their science. It actually inspires them, which is a very big difference. Take Raymond Damadian, who gives us the MRI machine by which we can see the inside of the human body, what's happening to my arthritic joints and so on. He loses his telephone, the university cuts it off, the Cancer Institute cuts off his grant, he plunders on, goes on, plunges on, and finally develops this thing. And I said, how did you do it? By faith in God. I know God was with me because I'm trying to bring something to the benefit of mankind. Now, it sounds a little, how can I put it?
Hokey?
Yes, right.
Sorry, I don't mean to give you the words.
No, but you know, that's exactly what many people would think. And in fact, it's not as very inspiring. Of course, another thing which is very important, just put aside religion for a minute, most of these people were not moved by greed. They may have accumulated a fortune, but that's an incidental of solving their intellectual puzzles, of reaching a goal they set out to reach.
Some of it almost strikes me as just, you know, people being motivated by creative urges or being driven by the desire to see things synthesized or to do things almost playfully in some instances.
That's exactly right. They see something. I mean, here's the start of innovation. If you get frustrated, like you're bound to do, for instance, dealing with the telephone today, press 3 if you're insane. Press 4 if you are not insane. Whatever. Somebody who could deal with that would be, it's a marvelous innovation. I've got to try and work it out how I can deal with it. But most innovations spring from a frustration, I mean, or from a vision. Take Fred Smith and Federal Express. How do you get a heart pacemaker quickly from somewhere in the wilderness of America, from a hospital in Boston? How do you get it there quickly? So the idea that somebody might die for the slowness of delivery, Fred Smith invents Federal Express, innovates Federal Express.
Which of the, I mean, you're dealing with so many different kinds of innovators here, which one really surprised you or took you off the seat of your pants, so to speak, most, do you think?
I think what really surprised me was one Tripp, who didn't invent a damn thing. He's a beach taxi pilot in Long Island, but he keeps getting hold of licenses to carry foreign mail into the Caribbean. And then he has this idea, again, a democratic idea of mass travel. And so he builds up an airline which becomes Pan American. But then the wonderful thing, putting together two things that are separate, he bullies Pratt & Whitney to give him a very large jet engine. He bullies Boeing to give him an airframe. He puts the two together. And out of it comes 747. And just think of it. At the moment, there are hundreds of thousands of Boeing 747s in the air. We're all connected because one Tripp had the idea to put these things together at the time when the airline industry said, to hell with jets. Now, I was so surprised to find a beach taxi pilot. Somebody was really a nobody, kind of semi-rich, in a sense, but taking these great risks. That surprised me.
Unpredictable in
every
way. Yeah.
You could never have predicted this guy offering you a $1 ride across the ocean and was going to end up owning virtually and controlling the biggest airline in the world and the most progressive airline. The number of firsts he had in radio communication, in the clipper ships, in the jets was incredible.
Talking to Harold Evans, whose new book is called They Made America, there's also a sense in many of these innovators of what you pinpoint as democratization, as a kind of spirit of democratization.
Yes. Well, I should have said that Juan Tripp, who was a democratizer, you know, the Clipper service started from San Francisco, Alameda. They end up bringing to the masses something that was available only to the rich before. I mean, Samuel Insull. How many people have heard of Samuel Insull?
He worked with Edison. Or Edison was his mentor, right?
Yeah, he came as an errand boy for Edison, and he was a very good errand boy. He was in English, and he spoke with a strange Cockney accent like this, you know. And so Edison could hardly understand him, especially since he was slightly deaf, so they had this kind of curious dialogue. But 10 years or so after he lands in New York, he's in charge of a little power station in Chicago. He has the same concept as Tripp. Let's go big. Let's build a huge power station. Now we've got tons of electricity, but how can we sell it? Oh, I know. Let's charge a lot for the heavy users at peak times, and let's charge almost nothing at other times. So you get the concept of peak demand for electricity. Amazingly simple
concept. And thus Commonwealth Electric.
Commonwealth Electric, which leads to lower electricity prices, and the whole industrialization of America depends on Samuel Insull's strange combination.
And thinking ahead, and thinking big, and thinking ambitiously.
And then, of course, like many people, he's pursued. He offends Wall Street, just as Giannini did. Mm-hmm. They try and break him. He flees to Europe. He's brought back to face a trial when, thank God for jurors, they acquit him instantly.
There's also the story you tell about Thomas Watson, which I think is, we're jumping ahead because, as I said, this takes us through a couple of centuries.
Yes.
But, you know, you talk to people, even uber nerds, they don't necessarily know the name Thomas Watson. You're, again, rediscovering history.
Well, there's Thomas Watson Sr., who is selling pianos off the back of a truck and stumbles on punch cards. And he founds what becomes IBM. His son comes in, who's a playboy, who is so appalled by his father's ambition, he's blowing smoke in his face at Thanksgiving dinners. He's really a terrible person, Thomas Watson Jr. You know, he's like something out of the 20s, the Roaring Twenties, out of Fitzgerald. But when he inherits the company, virtually inherits it, he sees the potential for the computer and takes this amazing gamble, because they come to him, the electronics people, with all sorts of diagrams and boxes and said, if you could crash this into production, we could really sell a lot of these, but we're not absolutely sure. He doesn't know the first thing about with these boxes and connections, but he takes the plunge and he introduces the large mainframe computer, which is the beginning of the computer age, thanks to Thomas Watson, whose wife just died this last week.
Yeah, he really revolutionized the whole industry. Plus, when you mentioned Juan Trippi, I mean, you know, the 747s and the whole change in terms of mass aviation, he was also the founder of Pan Am, wasn't he?
He did found. He ran Pan Am. He ran Pan American, exactly right. And, of course, he's very romantic, especially from the West. When he first tries to go across the Pacific, he has a meeting, and they say, but we can't do it. We can't fly nonstop across the Pacific. He's so smart, he planned ahead. He'd gone to the New York Public Library, found where the Clipper ships used to pause on tiny specks not visible on a map, and that's where he went and built airfields, and which they became famous during the war, of course, these little specks.
Lots of stories here, reclaiming history. The book is They've Made America. Harold Evans is our guest. This is a pre-recorded edition of Forum. We'll continue with Sir Harold. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Michael Krasny. I'm talking with Harold Evans, author of The American Century and a new book called They Made America. I was looking at a Washington Post review which says They Made America, written as part of a collaboration with public television, is not just a fascinating, stylishly written history of innovation in America, it's also a remarkably good history of the United States as seen through the eyes of a peripatetic British newspaper editor. You don't mind that adjective, do you?
I don't mind. It sounds as though I'm in a hurry.
During the break, Harold was doing some looking up, and much to our amazement, since we're recording this before Thanksgiving, the first Clipper went off right around Thanksgiving, 1935.
November 1935, yeah. And in Alameda. And the amazing thing was that nobody thought the Pacific could be flown. But as I say, he'd found these Wake, Guam, little islands, and when the Clippers landed there, thanks to Tripp, he'd sent over a huge ship, And they had hotels and towels and drinks and servants all ready to meet the first Clipper people. Very romantic period, this. Of course, one of the tragic things is that the guy who flies, captain, who flies it later, is killed in a curious mid-air storm accident.
Here you are now talking with us on FM radio, and it occurred to me that a man by the name of Edward Armstrong, whom you portray in here, important figure in terms of FM radio, to put it mildly.
Yeah. Well, FM was invented by Edwin Armstrong in 1935. And a demonstration in New York City, people were absolutely stunned that from Yonkers, where the broadcast began in a parlor, into New York City, they heard the pouring of water in a glass. They heard Mozart that had never heard it before, because he got rid of all the static. And the story of FM radio is really a story of, the triumph of virtue, but over corporate power. Because Sarnoff, who ran RCA...
David Sarnoff.
Yeah, was actually manufacturing AM radios at great profit, which also Armstrong had helped to innovate. So he didn't want FM radio ending this wonderful production of AM, so he sabotaged Armstrong. So Armstrong, innovator, went off and created his own FM stations, put up the... huge terminal aerial in Alpine, New Jersey, which was used, by the way, in 9/11 because it was the only surviving thing that could get the signals out when the World Trade Center went down. And then, can you believe this, Michael? Yes, you probably can. Sarnoff then claims that he invented FM. So Edwin Armstrong has to take Sarnoff to court. And you know how long they take? Depositions take years and years because they're playing a waiting game. Mr. Armstrong, would you spell that? Is it spelled with an A or an E? Was the second letter an R or an M? Is the third letter an S? Could we take that testimony again?
You're not exaggerating. This is really the way
this
it was.
This is exactly what happened. And so in the end, Armstrong spent all his money. He has to go home one night to the River House in New York, and he says to his wife, "You know, I'm sorry, but I've spent all the money fighting this case because everything's at stake, including my honour and the future of FM radio." And his wife just breaks down and he hits her with a poker over the arm. He loves her dearly, but he's just so beside himself. So she goes off to her mother in Connecticut. Edwin Armstrong gets ready for court. He puts his briefcase and his stuff and puts his hat and his overcoat on and jumps to his death from the window of the River House. That was because Sarnoff killed him, really. Well, the funeral, Sarnoff says, "I didn't kill him, did I?" "Yes, you did, actually."
Another very dramatic and sad story. A lot of people, I suppose, in your research, just didn't make the cut, but you would have liked them to be included in this?
Oh, there are people like that. I think I've put a list of 100 at the end whom I might have given a book of 1,000 pages and interminable patience from the readers. I might have written them up longer. But the ones I chose were the ones who represented a multidisciplinary approach to innovation, from steam to electronics, electromagnetic era, right up to today with the search engines and the computer and the personal computer. Gary Kildall, who gave everybody who has a personal computer the basic operating system, which was snitched by Microsoft. I tell that very dramatic story. And all of those people, I think, are worth the space. And so I had to choose in the end. I made a list at the beginning of about 700 people. But, I mean, in San Francisco, I've just been conducting a discussion with Jeff Hawkins and Donna Dubinsky, who innovated the Palm Pilot. And they're there. And maybe next time, in addition, I may make more of them and see what happens to them next, because most of the lives I've written about are fulfilled lives. I've got Ted Turner in there, of course, of CNN. And I've got Russell Simmons of hip-hop. So I've got
even got the inventor of Barbie doll, which some would say, you know.
Well, that's an important invention. You know why? Not because until she came along, women are a very important part of innovation. I want to just say this. There ought to be more women, but they were denied opportunities for so long, denied capital. And their
The same could be said, of course, of people of color and minorities.
Well, African Americans, even more so. Of course, women didn't get the vote till 1920, and it took about till the 60s till African Americans got the vote really in real life. But here we have a woman, Ruth Handler, who in the creation of the Barbie doll, where you can take the clothes and change them, you can change, the Barbie doll can be an air pilot, a lawyer, a doctor, a presidential candidate. Maybe that's what's coming next, but you could be any of these things. So she changed the perception of the roles that women might play, young girls might play. She fed their up. So she's a very significant figure at a time. Throughout most of the 200 years, the role for women was you stay in your place. Your place is in the home. And if you go into business, you are some kind of prostitute.
Of course, there's often that sort of pejorative association or negative association with. In fact, Marge Piercy wrote a poem about Barbie dolls.
Yes.
The Barbie dolls are somehow designed to inculcate in young women these sort of stereotypical views that still are all too extant.
I'd defend the Barbie doll, actually. When I think of the millions of young girls who've got great, including my own daughter, who's now 14, who got satisfaction from it, and that role-playing is very important when you're growing up, to have a role to play and an aspiration to nurture.
Was there an editor Barbie doll for Tina Brown, your wife? Or?
I don't think any doll could approximate the beauty and intelligence of my wife.
Oh, she's lucky to have this kind of PR machine behind her. Talk a little bit about that, though. I mean, you're married. You're really a power couple in New York, and you have high profile. And Tina Brown is an extraordinary woman in so many people's eyes. I mean, people who love her and hate her. She's still an extraordinary
woman.
She
shouldn't be hated by anybody. The only people who hate her don't know, and they're a minority on the lunatic fringe. Like Russ Limbaugh, for instance, who keeps attacking her for some stupid reason. The basic thing about her is what she did for The New Yorker, I think, was a fantastic achievement. Take a magazine that was dying and revive it and staffed it, and all the same people are still there. And to take Vanity Fair, which was about to be killed, and she saved that. And now she's doing a talk show on television and writing a column for The Washington Post. She has the resilience and courage of many of the innovators in this book, and so I am unashamed, whether you call it PR or husbandly duty, I'm unashamed in saying that.
You two have been together how long now?
25 years.
And live in Manhattan mainly? Or?
Yeah, we live in Manhattan. We have two children, a boy of 18 who's captain of the cross-country team and in school in Cape Cod, and I have a daughter who knows Latin better than I do. She's 14.
Nil desperandum. But what about going over to the UK?
Nil desperandum is the Royal Air Force motto, and I was in the Royal Air Force. I went over to the UK to get knighted, which was a very pleasant ceremony, as we've discussed. But I live in America now. I've lived here for 20 years, and I find that I am exhilarated by the mobility, freedom, diversity, and excitements of the United States, though occasionally down periods.
Well, let's talk about some of these other people that you obviously admire and in whose lives you became caught up as a historian and journalist, because there are some really fascinating stories here. For example, I found the Colt story pretty fascinating. A teenager, just kind of looking at a revolving chamber and suddenly, boom, there he is, you know.
He whittles it in wood.
Unbelievable.
And young Colt, by the way, nobody should ever call him anything except Sam Colt. Sam, not Samuel. Sam Colt was a really reckless spendthrift, a spoiled brat right at the beginning. He let people down left, right, and centre. But, I mean, just to take, for instance, the first revolver, six-shooter he made was at Paterson, New Jersey. It got into the hands of the Texas Rangers, who stunned raiding Comanches by being able to fire six shots at a time. You know, the Comanches used to be able to run 100 yards in 12, 13 seconds with lances and fire four or five arrows while they were doing it. So the soldiers had no chance until the revolver came along. And then the revolver which Samuel Walker used against the Comanches is, I say, from this bankrupt factory. Colt goes into a terrible period of decline. He's starving in New York City. He meets Morse. He studies chemistry. He blows a few things up. He always likes blowing things up. And then he hears that Walker's in New York City, 1846. Walker's come to raise a cavalry to fight against the Mexicans. And they get together and they produce the real Colt peacemaker. And that is why America won the Mexican War and gained California, for instance, a small matter that we're interested in here in San Francisco. And Colt dies at 47. But Walker dies before him because he's killed in the Mexican War.
The whole history that you lay out here, I mean, it's two centuries. It's kind of a history in some ways that, you know, there are ongoing battles among historians, and I believe they still are ongoing to this day, about how history is shaped. Is it shaped by institutions? Is it shaped by what Terry Eagleton called the superstructure? In other words, the culture and all of that, the economy, the ideologies, and so forth. And then there are those historians who feel that what really shapes history are individuals. And to some extent, you've made that case here, haven't you?
I do make that case. I don't follow War and Peace and Tolstoy, that it's all these. I tell you, I think individuals obviously come out of gathering social forces. But to pretend that without those individuals, the gathering social forces would have produced anything except a kind of benevolent anarchy is silly. The individuals, as I demonstrate in this book, without the Wright brothers, for instance, we'd still be as close to flight as Leonardo da Vinci was, probably. It's too easy to say, oh, somebody would have invented if they hadn't done it. Who?
People often do say that, of course, they say, about every innovation, don't they?
Yeah, but they don't study the subject enough, with due respect, because if you look at the history of flight, everybody was wrong. Where were they wrong? What do you think? Oh, we need a lot of energy to fly. No, you don't. What you need is to be able to control the machine. Do you need a lot of energy to cycle a bicycle? No, not really. No. But you have to be able to control it and have to balance. And that was the secret of... They were not bicycle mechanics by chance. You might say it was divine inspiration. But you could have had another century with people trying to put bigger and bigger engines into something with wings on it, either flapping the wings or whatever, and still not learning how to fly. They were the first test pilots. My guess is it probably would have been another 50 years before anybody like them came along. And they were a unique combination. Orville and Wilbur had that magical combination of inventiveness, imagination, vision, and persistence. And they did the whole thing for very little money.
It's often persistence, isn't it?
Oh, persistence is the commonest characteristic. In fact, Edison said, so many inventors, innovators, give up just when they're a point of success. And it's not helped in the current climate of where the media is generally very money conscious. So as soon as somebody starts something new, the headlines come up, so and so and so and so still in the red, as if that's the beginning and the end of things. Give them a break. It takes 5 years. George Doriot, the first venture capitalist who's profiled in my book, says, you know, people are always saying, hey, we've had 2 years of this and it's not worked. He says, would you kill a child at the age of 2 years if it had whooping cough, or would you wait to see if you could grow the child to 5 or 10? And most of our great industries have required that kind of patience.
Which is something we seem to be running short on in the United States. I mean, let's face it. I was thinking, in fact, of embryonic stem cell research, which a lot of people have great hopes for, and I hope that those hopes are realized. But the alacrity with which they feel that some of those hopes are going to come into fruition is just way inflated from what realistically ought to be the incubation stage.
It's going to take time. It's going to take time, but you can't stop it and ought not to stop it, in my view. The moral decision about whether to... use the results of the stem cell research, whether it be 10 years, 20, 30 or 40 years, are one issue. But the issue of impeding the scientific discovery of truth and the marvelous wonders of our universe, you know, just think of Galileo being obstructed as he was. And ignorance is no substitute for happiness. And I think my perception of God is somebody who believes in truth.
We're talking with Harold Evans. His book is They Made America. Speaking about believing in truth, I mean, as we've said, noted, so many of these stories have such different kind of dramatic pieces to them and are novelistic, as you said. Louis Tappan comes to mind here because Louis Tappan was really motivated deeply by anti-slavery.
He was. Louis Tappan is a very Christian man who runs a shop with his brother in Pearl Street, Manhattan. They are appalled by slavery. They want emancipation quickly. Now, many people in New York did not want that. They were trading with the South. The South is furious about Tappan's abolitionist activities, and so a boycott is called. A severed Negro's ear is sent to Arthur, for instance, and a ransom is put on his head to be delivered. Arthur said, oh, my God, I didn't know it was worth that much. I might give myself up. But Lewis and he then have to get into trouble. They start giving credit. The credit's bad. So Lewis Tappan is inspired. What if we could make sure the credit was good, that somebody coming from Alabama really did have a good reputation? So he's put spies around the country, agents, you might say, one of whom is Abraham Lincoln. And they report on the honesty and creditworthiness of these individuals, out of which comes Dun & Bradstreet. Now, this is important, not just for business, but for the whole sustaining of America, because in the 1840s, 1850s, 1860s, after the Civil War, right up to the end of the century, America is short of money, specie, gold and silver. It can only sustain its resurgence by credit. There's no credit. No credit without credit rating. You're just too much risk, too much recession, too much damage. So his invention of a credit rating system is one of the primary engines of America, just like Oliver Evans and the high-pressure steam engine and the Wright brothers and the aircraft.
All of these things, as they come to pass, make me think in a strange way of how during the boom and during the IPO madness and everything, it was as if everybody suddenly thought they had a cornerstone on innovation, as if, you know, it was out there and could just be brought down into this new economy and with this new technology. But as I think you point out through the book, not only is persistence required in what I would call an embryonic period or an incubated period and so forth, but that kind of, although things happen sometimes very suddenly, you know, eureka and all that, but for the most part, we're talking about real context, process, a trajectory.
Yeah, absolutely. And we take, let's go back to the incandescent light, Thomas Edison. You know how many times he had to try before he got an incandescent light to work a piece of cotton, carbonized cotton? 3,000 experiments, and only two of them had any chance of working. Every experiment he began looked as though it was going to be a success.
My father used to tell me a story about Edison, and I wonder if it's just apocryphal or not. I've always been meaning to ask, and I'm going to ask you because I've never asked anybody else because you know an immense amount about all these people. My father used to say that Edison would invite, because it ties in with your book in some ways, or some of the motifs in your book, Edison would invite people who were prospective hirees over to his house, and he would serve them soup. And if they put salt in their soup before they ate it, he would not hire them because it showed that they were not adventurous and that they were not, didn't have the kind of curiosity that he deemed important to drive toward innovation.
That sounds credible. I haven't, I can't document it, but Edison used to give people intelligence tests, which would be things like, which is the town with the biggest laundry in the United States? Or what is the cubic weight of, what is the weight of air in a room so many by so many? Who was Demosthenes? And he'd give these questions to carpenters and electricians. So
common knowledge, really, more than intelligence.
Well, but he regarded it as intelligence. He thought if you hadn't ranged over a variety of subjects, you couldn't be intelligent. So the kind of person who would put salt in his tea, in his soup, probably in Edison's mind, was the kind of person who wouldn't open Shakespeare because it was kind of a foreign playwright.
Let me get back to one of your, you mentioned Russell Simmons, and that would surprise some people. And yet what he did with hip hop and with, I mean, he wasn't necessarily an inventor of that kind of music, although I guess he did cut a few labels and things of that sort, but for the most part, it was just, again, the synthesizing, wasn't it?
Synthesizing is almost the commonest example of innovation, to put things together that were not put together before, like a little yellow post-it, put a bit of glue on it, synthesis, you know? So the synthesis with Russell Simmons was to take hip-hop, which was the music of the ghetto, and think that it could cross racial barriers and appeal to white youth too, although he didn't have that perception originally. When it did appeal to white youth, he realized what he had. And when the Def Jam Records hit a bad patch, he started Def Jam Poetry and Def Jam Comedy, and then he moved into making clothing to appeal to that generation.
He was on this program and brought me some fat shoes, that PHAT shoes.
The nice thing about Russell Simmons, I think, a guy who could have gone so badly wrong, who was a drug runner in his youth, mm-hmm. who took a shot at somebody, who was safe, thank God, because he missed deliberately, he says, and I believe him. The nice thing about him is that his example of what somebody, he wasn't really in the ghetto, his parents were actually middle-class African-Americans, that somebody like that could create a whole new business and enterprise is apparently very inspiring to young black kids today in the schools. And actually, you can go in and hear them do the poetry, the Def Jam poetry and stuff. So I think he's a benevolent influence, and he's certainly a master marketeer.
What about then someone like Colonel Tom Parker, who was able to cross the color line the other way? I mean, he really gave us Elvis Presley. He took black music and made it mainstream when it was in an apartheid situation.
Well, you should write a book about him, and I'll be glad to quote it in my next edition.
Well, he was a scoundrel. I mean, and he fleeced Elvis, and
he was
actually a Dutch carny guy who made a whole career out of Elvis. But he really did, to some extent, what you suggest Simmons did.
Well,
I mean, synthesizing.
We need synthesizing is very, very, very important. And say many of the people, Martha Harper was synthesizing beauty methods and retail franchising. Sarah Breedlove Walker, who became Madam C.J. Walker, Sarah Breedlove was her initial name, she put together ideas of Annie Malone. Turnbro became Pope later on in her life, and synthesized them, and then got the idea of starting agencies and so on. So many people in my book are people who didn't actually sit down and cry eureka, but who saw two or three things that should be pulled together, and when they pulled them together, they created this something marvelous for the rest of us.
Talk a little bit about the Google story. I mean, particularly since it's local to some extent, and it's so much in the news now.
Yeah. Well, here's the point. Building on things. There'd been search engines before. So they've not invented something. We have to go back to the electron, which Edison missed, and the whole process you can see building up to where there's this multiplicity of information we can't find our way. But they bring out Google with a formula, by the way, based on a Russian mathematician, which I describe, which is a more refined search, and they don't clutter their first page with ads. They're very neatly contained. Google has to go on developing because, though I use it immensely, if I type in Harold Evans and get 400,000 entries, I want something more precise than that. In fact, some people would think one entry would be superfluous. So they need to refine it, and they're going to keep doing that. And now they're being challenged by Microsoft, which tries to squash all kinds of new competition from its semi-monopoly position. So I'm hoping that Google will continue to innovate. One of the lessons of innovation, and George Dorio said this, the moment of success is very dangerous because you stop innovating. You think you've arrived. My message to Sergey Brin and Larry Page is keep on innovating. You've got to keep on innovating.
In that story, though, I mean, it was partially the desire to keep on innovating, as you just intimated, but there was also kind of a brand name that emerged. I mean, it's extraordinary how we say, I'm going to Google something.
It's like FedEx. And how many people know what a Google is? And I'm not going to tell you. What is a Google?
I don't know.
Well, read my book and you'll find out what a Google really is.
I did read your book, but I didn't read that section.
It's a wonderful description of for what they're doing.
That's a good tease to get someone to buy the book.
Oh, of course
too.
It is.
Very clever of you, Harold.
You could open an addiction if you don't want to buy the book. But it's worth looking because that's the kind of curiosity I want to stimulate.
And that is your motivation? I mean, you're not out to sell books. You're in a phase of your life where you really want to make a contribution to stimulate curiosity, make young people curious again.
Yes, it is, actually. It's not a way to become rich. And like most of the people in my book didn't set out to become rich or make a fortune. As Giannini said, no man owns a fortune, it owns him. And they set out to solve an intellectual puzzle or do a service. And sometimes, quite often, that resulted in them getting quite well off. Sometimes it didn't. They ended up in poverty, like Edwin Drake, who found oil in Pennsylvania, made a fortune for others. So any author who writes a book has to have some other objective than making money, because he sure as hell is not going to end up rich.
Well, but also you have your wife now as a TV star, and you have all of that.
I'm happy. I'm so excited. I've never been as excited in a book as I was when I discovered that nobody had done the history of 200 years, that I was coming across these amazing pieces of El Dorado, these stories, these novellas, if like, which had been untouched by anybody. And here was I opening the box for the first time, and out was coming all this romance and drama, achievement, and also it was making explicable the progress of America of 200 years, which is totally inexplicable if you don't look at the politicians. Those who despair about the last election result, take heart, because politics is only part of the life, and what's happening with individuals can make a greater difference than anybody in the White House.
Well, you are an innovator and a synthesizer, as evidenced by this book. The book is They Made America by Harold Evans. You had a few collaborators on this, I guess, or a few people who helped you with the research.
I had a researcher called Gail Buckland, who I employed for 4 years to go and find photographs. So I said, I don't want men with mutton chop whiskers. So she found me a picture of Edison thinking. She found me a picture of Theodore Judah, the Transcontinental Railway, starting from Sacramento, because San Francisco missed the opportunity. Anyway, people like that, wonderful picture. And I had a young fellow from Harvard, Oxford, and the Sorbonne, reasonable qualifications, called David Leffer, and to help me identify what I should read and bring stuff out of archives for me. So I was they stuck with me for 4 years, which suggests a certain sublime willingness to sacrifice.
Well, Jack Welch, no less, says, terrific and inspiring stories about the dreamers and doers who dared to create the modern face of this great nation. Again, as They Made America by Sir Harold Evans, from the steam engine to the search engine, 2 centuries of innovators. Harold, so good, nice to see you again. Thank you so much.
And thank you for being on this innovative and charming program.
Appreciate that. And we'll be back with you at our regular time. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Our producers are Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., Kevin Guillory, and Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Seal Muller. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us at KQED, I thank you. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.